This is the Empower Podcast. Released February 26th, 2023. Episode 621. The Magic of Calipers.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
I am going to defend myself, damn it.
About what?
You think it's undefendable what I've done?
No. No. You have a particular way of doing things. Usually.
No.
My big problem was watching this whole thing unfold.
Yeah, you watched it live. Okay.
I watched part of it live, and yeah. And Dave was trying to get, it was your iOS app, is that right, for the multimeter?
Yes, and I wanted to upload it to GitHub so that people could have it.
Yeah, you were basically crowdsourcing from your audience, like your secondary channel stream, yep. And people were very helpful, but there was a lag.
Chat is hard. Getting live help is hard. Yeah. Because there's it can be up to a 30-second lag between.
Yeah, exactly. People. Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You want to defend yourself. Go for it.
I will defend myself. The first thing you said there is plural. I have a particular way of doing things. Now, here is the crux of it, right? What I wanted to do was not things. It was not a process. It was one thing. I wanted to do one task and then never touch it again. Okay? All I wanted to do was I had existing code, right? An existing project. All I wanted to do at the request of somebody on my forum is put it on my GitHub account so that other people could then use their GitHub and branch it and do whatever and use it, right?
Yeah, there it
is. I want to share it with the world.
Fork it and clone it and all that good stuff.
Which they've already done, right? That's all I wanted to do. Incredibly simple, one-off, and this is my defense, a one-off task, okay? Mm. I am not versioning controlled. I'm not doing a project using the GUI interface on GitHub. I'm doing is one task.
File storage, effectively.
I could have just dumped it to a Dropbox somewhere, right? But everyone uses GitHub, right? Everyone uses Git, right?
But they use it for revision control, so.
Yep.
Not that important if it, I mean, you don't want to give a Dropbox thing because.
No, it's silly. And I wanted to have it on my, because I do have a GitHub account, right? So I wanted to put it on my. I started off putting it on the GitLab account, which is a different system to GitHub. But anyway, we'll get into that. So all I wanted to do was one task, right? And you got to remember, I don't use Git. Right?
Right.
I don't use Git. Yep. And I'd love to learn Git. Okay. That's a fine thing to do. I'd love to learn it. But for this one task that I simply wanted to spend a couple of minutes doing, I did not want to learn Git for that. Okay. Yeah. So GitHub has a drag and drop interface. All you have to do is create the repository, drag the files over, done. It's literally tens of seconds of work.
Yeah.
But the problem was it had a 100 file limit and I had 800 files, right?
Right, right.
So I went, I'll upload it to my GitLab account. And GitLab didn't let you do that either. So, I was getting frustrated. How do I do 100, more than 100 files, right? So, I tried on Twitter, asked on Twitter. No one could explain it to me properly, right? So I did a live show and then people eventually, were trying to help me out on a live show. And we eventually got it, right? After 45 minutes or something, you would quit by this time. You would quit in frustration, right, by watching this. And as it turns out, I followed everyone's instructions down to the T and it didn't work, right? Because GitLab.
Right. You were doing it over HTTPS instead of SSH. You didn't have a token on your machine.
Yeah. GitLab. And I do have a GitLab account. And that's where my existing multimeter code is for my Android. That's why I wanted to put Apple code on there as well. And it didn't work because it required a secure connection.
It required a HTTPS,
It required secure keys, right? It required secure keys. Yeah. At that point, I just gave up. And right. I just manually uploaded batches of things to batches of files to GitHub.
Mm.
But as it turns out, right, all these GitHub experts, thank you very much for helping me. It's awesome, by the way. Thank you very much. Yeah. But not one of them could tell me that you can easily do it on GitLab by simply opening up the GUI IDE interface and dragging your files over. Done. 2 seconds. Somebody emailed me after this.
And nobody really uses it like that.
Exactly. And a lot of people have attacked me, or some people have attacked me on Twitter over this, saying, oh, you know, only idiots use the GUI interface.
Oh, well, that's like, not right. No.
Right? No, it's not. Yeah. Right? And this is why I'm defending myself, because I wanted to do one task. Sure, if I was going to work on the project from GitHub, I'd learn the Git commands and do it properly. Right? But I didn't want to do that. I'm not working on this project.
Sure.
I just wanted to upload it. So can you accept my defense that I had one task to do and I wanted it to take a trivial amount of time?
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
And there would be other people like me who have that requirement.
Let me give you some of my GitHub history, because I started in a very similar place to you, actually, on this stuff. Mm. I really, really struggled. And you know, everybody told me not to use the GitHub desktop, which was actually pretty underdeveloped at the time. So it was kind of like
a few people told me to use that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. And that is kind of like
I didn't want to download a program to do it. Totally, I'm going, totally. Well, the web interface should work, you know.
Right, right. And I think they've gotten better, actually, you know, now we know that there is this web interface. That's better for that sort of thing. I think some of it is kind of mindset shift too. And it's like, I was used to kind of, I would think about like uploading like an IDE or like working from an IDE like sample project or something like that. And there would just be this kind of this huge chunk of files, like hundreds of files like you're talking about. And really that doesn't work great. And I think also because, like, you know, sometimes you get the build directory involved, and then it's like, so then every time you do another build, all those files look different to the system.
Yeah,
but
it's
like,
right.
But you don't really, you don't want to upload those.
Yes. You don't want the build file. Can't you just exclude the build folders?
You can't. Yeah. I didn't know how to do that, though. Right, that's the thing. So I just saying, like, the growing pains of like learning this sort of system. And then another thing that I really struggled with when I started doing Zephyr stuff back when I was doing my ABC board was I was like, do I, you know, Zephyr is this massive, like, download, like gigabytes. And so
I had that on my computer. Hideously complex stuff, right? It's FPGA kind of a tool.
It's complex. Like, and then it also pulls in a lot of, like, you know, vendor libraries.
So,
like,
vendor stuff. And
exactly. So like when you download like the default, when you start from like Zephyr, you're getting all of the every supported platform pretty much, like STM 30, unless you like go in and really saying like, oh, actually I only want this one chip platform, which is a pretty complex task to go and do. You'll get all of the microchip stuff, all the STM stuff,
even
all
if
the
you
Nordic
don't
stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just don't know it's there. And then, I had this huge directory. I was working out of a sample folder, like you do, like you kind of showed in that RISC-V video, right? You're working out of the sample folder.
Yeah, right.
Cause that's the right way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, okay, well now I want to like commit these changes, but do I commit the whole thing? And then it was like the entire SDK, and that's like 2 gigabytes. And I was like, this can't be right. And I just remember like being like waiting for like hours for this thing to upload. And then like, I don't own that code. I shouldn't have that on my GitHub. Right. And so like, just kind of like that, just the kind of that understanding of that learning process of like, of how to do it. The biggest thing for me was like having someone like I could watch do it. That was super important for me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what I'm trying to say, Dave, is, you know, if you want to look over my shoulder at some point, I'll show you how to write really bad code.
Thank you.
Really, awesome. Really bad code.
That's what I strive to do, is be a bad coder. Yeah. And it's,
just good enough to get over the hump. That's what we shoot for here at the Amp Hour.
See, people can think I don't appreciate version control. I do. I worked it out here. I used to use version control daily. We use Tortoise SVN, though. Which, you know, there's quite a lot of people who actually like that Tortoise SVN interface. Sure. But
Subversion's a little different. It's in terms of like, it kind of
Subversion is the name for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's the SVN part. Yeah, it's a little different, but you know, Git's like, it's weird at the beginning. You know,
I can totally understand it, but when I simply wanted to do a task that should have taken like seconds.
Have you done Git rebase, Dave? Because that doing that for months and I have no idea what it does still.
Right. No, I have no idea what a rebase is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Like there's like all these like it feels like magic. It's just like these magic incantations, but like, you know, I'm starting to actually get it. Yeah. But like, you know, at the beginning it's just like, what does this even mean? You know, and like the idea of like, you know, a local head versus the remote, and it's just,
to be fair, there are quite a few people who actually on Twitter, they actually came in defense and said, look, to be honest, Git is not for noobs or for people who just use it casually or something like that. It's you know.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm saying here as well. I think it is tough. It's a tough learning curve. And especially because I think the common suggestion is like go straight to the command line. And some people aren't comfortable in the command line either.
Well, I can certainly do the command line. I do quite a few command line things. I've got, you know, command line scripts that do my video encoding and do other stuff. It's like, you know, it isn't foreign to me. It's just that when you want to do a simple task once and, you know, and it bites you in the ass, it's like, you know. Anyway, it wasn't Git that bit me in the ass. It was the GUI. It was the GUI version, which simply had 100 file limit. So, you know. As like
I'm guessing they must do that to like prevent like abuse or something.
Abuse,
I don't know,
something like that, but like maybe 100 is really low, like just as you said, like, or when you include lots of, you know, when you've got tons of includes and everything, a simple project like this one app, my app has 880 files in it, you know, it's like and that doesn't include any, you know, Mac OS crap subdirectories either, that's just like the code with all of its includes and whatnot. So, So I think 100's too few. So I don't know what the rationale is there.
I also remember from the video that you were like looking at like, what are all these files here? Some of it was when you were uploading the .git folder. That's like a kind of hidden folder.
Yes, that was it. Yeah, because another issue is that I didn't actually technically start from scratch because there was an existing .git folder in there or something weird like that was messing it up, and you know, all sorts of factors contributed to make it look frustrating and caused you to storm out in disgust.
So like that's where, you know, when you think about it, like there's like a local version and a remote version, and it tracks like the changes that you, when you do a commit, it changes, you know, it says like, oh, Dave changed, you know, the copyright date or something like that, right? And that's a small change. But like that then becomes an actual atomic change within your local, that in that .git folder. And then you think about all the changes you might do over time. Those really start to add up in terms of the number of, they're small files, but there's a lot of them. And then it keeps all that history.
You can
roll back the entire history. Yeah. So like if you wrote an entire project, you know, and you kept that history, or say you even cloned a project from a remote repository to your computer, you can actually go back and say, oh, you know, Dave did a commit on January 13th of 2023, and the commit number is, you know, ABC123456, whatever. I can go and say, go to that commit number and create a new branch from that. And I would, all of your code is there. It's really,
It's very cool. Yes, I love version control. It's great.
Yeah.
Which is why I wanted to give my code, instead of just putting it on a Dropbox somewhere, I wanted to do it properly and put it on GitHub.
Sure.
You know,
what is your, what does the app do? I actually don't know. What does the app do? Is just controlling the multimeter?
It just controls the multimeter. Yeah. But my app apparently has vanished from the Apple Store, and I have no idea why. It's vanished. Weird. But apparently there is a third party company that actually wrote an app for my meter, which I didn't know about, which is great.
That's cool.
So at least there is still an app there until I can figure out how to somehow get it back on the Apple Store. But I don't know. Maybe I'm not paying my dues or something. I can't remember. Yeah. So I didn't do that. That was David too, who did that. He's, like handled all the Apple app and stuff. He's the one who wrote it, uploaded and registered it, and, you know, did all that sort of stuff. So I have no idea how it works. I have no idea how any of this Apple app verification or whatnot works. Yeah. I assume it's, I don't know, do you have to like continually update them to stay update with the latest Apple version? Otherwise it just like drops you off the Apple store. I got no idea
anything with app stores, honestly. I don't know. It's interesting because I've started to look into some of that, you know, there's like these different app platforms and stuff like that where you can kind of have kind of quick start apps there. But even then, I've never really done like the Bluetooth modes either, you know, like, so that's where you see a lot of that stuff.
Yeah,
like
we've talked about this before, but the combination of doing Bluetooth development and Apple and app development is the most horrendous experience.
Yeah.
possible. Yeah. You've got layer. Yeah. It's just awful.
I mean, yeah, pick your poison, right? I mean, like, is it either that or deal with cell companies or deal with Wi-Fi or, you know, like if you're going to be connected, it's like you're, yeah, it's, I was actually just talking to someone about that the other day where it is, you know, when you think about like, you know, hardware people, when they think about Bluetooth, it's like the interface, the internet effectively is the phone, right? The phone is a very powerful device at this point. It's basically a Linux computer almost always. Apple and Android are Linux computers. And they, you know, then are that, they're almost always talking
to HTTP. Is Apple still a Linux computer? Doesn't Apple run right. Apple iOS or
it's
whatever?
iOS, but that's based on Unix.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Leave.
Right.
Ooh. I might be wrong about that. Am I wrong about that?
I thought maybe that was based on Unix. Way back. Maybe it's not anymore. I have no idea.
So, oh, Unix-like. That's what it means.
Unix-like.
Says.
Okay. Yep. Mm,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, actually. Oh, that's interesting because, yeah, so the stuff that goes on the laptops is definitely Unix-derived. Unix-like based on Darwin, which is BSD.
It's based on Darwin. Yeah, I'm reading it now. Yeah based on Darwin, whatever that is, which is a Unix.
Way
spin-off.
Above my head. That's above my pay grade, that's for
Darwin
sure.
Darwin BSD, okay. Which is Berkeley software distribution.
Ooh, interesting.
Darwin operating system. Okay. So it's based on the Darwin operating system. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
But like just the idea of then of like, so now even if you were doing Bluetooth, right, you're kind of handing these packets to the phone at that point, and then you're like, the app developer will take care of it at that point, you know, like, and it's like, that's a very different thing. Like a lot of the stuff I'm doing these days is, you know, in some cases, like the Thread stuff I do, I actually have a IPv6 address. Like, so like these little Bluetoothy devices, they are going through a border router, it's called, but that actually assigns it an IPv6 address. So in theory, it's addressable from the broader internet.
Yes.
You have to go through this router, but it is an addressable thing versus like, as far as I understand it, I think there's some way you can do it in Bluetooth, but the standard way is that, you know, a Bluetooth device, if you have a little Fitbit watch talking through your phone, it doesn't have an IP address.
No.
It has a local address for your phone.
You could maybe somehow map it or something.
Yeah, like Bridget
or
Strauss,
some bridge
maybe,
or something, but I don't know. But yeah, it's
but,
not.
But like they're not built for that
it's
sort
not,
of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't directly address it. And you would have to use IP6 because IP4 you can't do because there's not enough IP4 addresses, right? That's the 192 dot, you know, that's the dot, you know.
The non-hex type stuff. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not sure why. I think it is because the preparation for all those addresses, but there's no like subnetting or anything like that either, right? If you wanted to have like,
well, you can do ports and stuff, like you can do like port mapping and
well,
stuff.
Well, you think about
you?
Like you have a Wi-Fi address. So you say you had like an ESP32, that thing can have an IP address, but usually it's going to have like a local IP address from handed over from your router. So your router has
exactly
like
your router maps a local one, which is not a well, and then you can port that through to the global network so that you can have other people access it. So that's when they come to your router IP address, and then they put in a port number, and you can map a port number to the local device. But that's kind of like a roundabout way to do it. So
yeah, I'm gonna be honest, that's outside my realm, but I do know that I do cellular stuff very often. Those are private IP addresses. Those are on the network, but you can't really access them from the broader internet. I've done Thread stuff. I don't do Wi-Fi too often. But then you think about like in those cases, you know, like the internet is the internet at that point, right? So if I wanted to go and, you know, ping Google, I can do that from a cellular device. I can actually like send out a ping over the network and it should get to the Google side of things. Whereas like a Bluetooth device, it would still have to go through the phone. The phone is serving up any kind of traffic that way. So yeah, networks, Dave.
Yeah, I don't know, that's not
let me tell you, speaking of cellular, I'm about 16 days away from leaving for Embedded World, and I'm freaking out a little bit. I'm in demo
time,
mode.
Huh?
Yeah
right.
I just hand assembled 8 boards tonight.
Nice. Yep.
And I got another 8 to do tomorrow, and I got a lot of testing to do.
These are like stand demos, are they? So that people can play with them?
Yeah, some of them are going to be like walking around demos. Some of them are going to be stand demos.
Oh, okay. All right.
A lot of 3D printing happening here. Some laser cutting. I'm just like a maker. I'm like a maker space in here, Dave.
Cool bananas.
I have to do some vinyl cutting. I have a vinyl cutter now. Did I tell you that?
No.
Like a sticker,
no, there
sticker
you go.
Cutter.
Wow.
Those things are super fun.
So it's got one of those blades, right? That sort of like
That's
goes
right.
around and... Right.
Yeah, yep. So it's like... basically the blade goes kind of across the x-axis, and then it like pushes the vinyl paper or the vinyl sticker in the y axis then. And so then when you map that, it basically can do a 2D shape, like a circle or, you know,
piece
of text or whatever.
How does it stretch the paper material sticker thing?
What do you mean by stretch it?
Because otherwise, like if you don't stretch it, if it just like how do you hold it in place? Otherwise it'd just tear it or whatever, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah. There are some lower limits. The thing that moves the vinyl in and out is like a tensioner rod, basically. So it has
it's a platen. It's a roll of platen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
And so that has like downward force, and it's got a really strong grip on the vinyl, and that's what actually makes it. That's what gives it tension.
Yes.
And it's like a known distance across as well.
Right.
But like then it's like super easy to like just drop in an SVG or something like that, and then the limit is just your imagination.
Nice. Yep.
Yeah.
Vinyl cut sticker front panels.
That's exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. 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 So right. I have I showed you last time, I made a PCB front panel.
Yep. Saw that.
And it's got an e-ink display, some backlight LEDs. I'm doing some vinyl cutter stickers on it. I should mention.
Why an e-ink display over a traditional LCD or OLED?
Yeah, that's a good question. The thought is that it showcases, you know, like, so these are cellular devices. And so the whole thing is on
low
I2C
power.
Bus.
Right.
Yeah. Low power, but really, you know, when you think about a lot of like cellular devices, if they're going to survive out in the wild at all, they're going to be mostly shut down all the time.
Yeah.
And with e-ink, when you update the screen and then you shut the whole thing off,
it stays there.
The display still is there. So that's kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And plus it's like super crisp. It looks great in like lighting conditions. So yeah, it definitely is a hassle, but like in terms of the updates, but yeah.
I think e-ink technology is one of the radical game changers in tech. I think, you know, because like just the ability to have a display just stay there with no power is just wow. It's a freaking mind blow, yet we sort of take it for granted now.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, a Kindle, no big deal.
Right, it just stays 20
years at this point, like I mean, low power lasts for, like, my Kindle lasts
zero
for,
power. It's literally zero power. It only draws power when there's a residual power because it's checking for the capacity of touchscreen, right? But apart from that, right, technically if you turn it off, it's off, and the image is still the book cover is still there.
Sure. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. You do Kindle?
Yeah, yeah.
For you?
Yep.
Yeah. I'm on mine pretty much every night and, you know, probably 20 minutes or so. And I think it goes 30 days, pretty standard.
Oh, yeah. You easily get a month's use out of Kindle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. Yep. Fantastic.
Yeah. I don't see it on a lot of products. It's still pretty expensive. So, like, this is a 200 by 200 screen, probably 12 centimeters by 12 centimeters. Not like a big screen.
Yeah.
And it's $5.
Yep.
Like not.
But when you say expensive, right, you got to remember they use these for disposable things.
Yeah.
Now, it's just like.
Oh, like those tags in the grocery store?
About e-ink shipping labels, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm, yeah.
That just a one-off thing goes on a package and then you toss it out. Like, hold, no.
I've never seen that. Have you seen that? I've never actually seen that.
Well, I've heard talk about it because they're so, you know, apparently cheap in volume if you want like a real simplistic one or something like that. And they're using them for supermarket like labels, shelf labels now. You know, they've got those.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, that's cool. I think that's a great use of them. And there's, I forget his name, but there's a hacker out there who basically like buys those in bulk and reprograms them.
It's great.
People that sell them for grocery stores are like super cheap.
Yep.
I forget who that is.
Yeah, when you buy them in that sort of volume, you know, because like one store would need what 10,000.
Oh yeah,
labels or something.
How many SKUs is in a just a large grocery store?
Yeah, a single store. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great use, you know.
Yeah.
So, but at least they're not disposable.
Yeah, exactly. Case, yeah, so. They're reprogrammable at that point. Yeah, and they have like there's some I forget how they update maybe RFID or something too.
Well, that's the other thing. Yes, they do update them via a RFID resonant coil in there. I think so you come along with the programmer. So there's no battery in there. Come along with the programmer, and it energizes the coil, and then it updates the display. And then once you remove the little handheld programmer thing, it's done, you know.
Yeah.
So, and there's the other, I can remember I was working way back when.
Are you saying there's wireless power, Dave? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there is wireless power.
Couldn't help myself.
And it was all the rage. Back when RFID tags were big, I'm talking probably late 90s, something like that, you know, all the rage and all the talk at the time was, oh, RFID tags will be embedded, and you know, these disposable RFID tags will be embedded in everything. Every single box that you ship will have an RFID tag on it because these things will be so cheap. You know, these little glass, back when they were like glass sphere kind of, you know, things, and they'd be taped to you and they were so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And they still are, I think, because there's not much in them. There's like a silicon die. There's a, you know, a little patch antenna and there's a...
Yeah, it's like chip down kind of thing, like chip on glass sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You can get chip on glass or you can get the pattern etched on glass as well. But, you know, but making glass isn't cheap. And then, you know, making silicon dies isn't cheap either. You know, well, it's cheap, you know, but should you use them in disposable applications where you can use a piece of paper? You know, it's like...
Right.
Yeah. That is the thing.
Where's the crossover point of like the hassle factor of like printing up new labels and
That's
a good point. Yeah. Before we move on from conference stuff, I wanted to mention again, if people are going to be there, first off, I'd love to meet with you. Let me know. Second off, former guest Saber from PCB Arts will be having an event there. Free tickets. I think there's beer and maybe food.
Ooh,
but basically bring a Hackstyle event on Wednesday night, the 15th of March.
Cool.
So I will have a link to that in the show notes once again. So
what swag do you have on your stand? What freebies?
Oh, nothing good.
No. Oh, come on.
Stickers.
What's, come on.
Yeah, I know. It's not a big stand. I mean, that's the thing. I'm going to be at the Zephyr stand. What's your go-to? What is the best ones?
Well, you've got to have lollies. You've got to either have lollies or you've got to have like a PCB ruler or something useful like that.
PCB rulers, that feels like e-waste to me. I know that you are famous for your PCB ruler, and DigiKey likes their ruler. I personally, I've seen so many of them, I'm like, these are just getting thrown out. I don't take them ever anymore.
But like, I see them in a bag. You gotta make them practical. You gotta make them like...
Sure. I don't use rulers though, you know what I mean? Like, I'll use a...
You don't use rulers, really?
No, I use calipers.
I got one right in front of me. I got an engineer. I don't have a PCB ruler right in front of me. I've got an proper engineering ruler, you know?
Sure.
Like a proper...
For measuring stuff or for the lookup stuff on it? What do you use it
No,
for?
It's an actual ruler. It's for measuring stuff. And this is a proper engineering one. And it's standard. Yeah. Like it's, you know, it's actually rated for a specific temperature. So it's standard at 25 degrees C, it says on here.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's made in the United States of America, USA.
Oh, nice. It's got metric on it, huh?
Inches on one side, metric on the other, and it's got your different scales. So, you know, your weird ass, you know, 1/16 of an inch and all that sort of rubbish, know?
Yep.
Yeah, and then it's got, you know, 0.5 mil on the other side.
Mm.
So that's not imperial mil, that's metric mil.
If I'm measuring anything, I'm measuring it with a set of calipers. Anything past like 6 inches, I'm probably going to a tape measure.
No. Every time I go to use a bloody pair of calipers, the battery's dead, you know, like... Every time.
I have that problem too. Mine also,
I swear I'm just going to get an old school dial one because it's just like, I'm just
That's
sick.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah. I think I'll just
Another thing to note is that the cheap ones, they don't have enough downward pressure. So another thing that I do, another tip for the caliper people out there, slide a piece of paper in underneath the cover so that it kind of pushes between the catch of the cover.
Mm.
You know, you can't block the battery contact, but, or no, actually you can, sorry. It's only once it gets the rim to the center, right?
It's usually a bottom contact on the PCB and then a rim thing. Yeah.
Right. So you can actually put a piece of paper on top. So you basically like take a piece of paper, put that in there. If that doesn't work, fold it over once, try again and fold it over again. And then like that, for me, it was almost always the battery was loose.
Yep.
So try that. See if that helps.
That's another piece of tech that I'm absolutely amazed by. Have you ever, even the cheapest piece of crap, you know, Shenzhen market $5 digital calipers, they're so super
they're
accurate and you can't trick them, right? Right? Like, like you stand there trying to trick it by moving it really fast. Oh, yeah, I'm going to beat this thing, you know, and you can't. It's incredible.
I can't. It depends on the piece of crap. If it's not the rack and pinion style. So like that is basically my minimum. Is that it has to be rack and pinion. Because if there's like the really, really cheap ones where it's basically just like a roller on like a piece of plastic and like that can skip.
They're all like that because they use a capacitive sensor inside. They use a capacitive surface inside to actually detect So it doesn't matter if it slips. It's the movement of the capacitor and how fast that they can read it and update it.
Maybe I don't know how calipers work. Okay. No, I thought it was number of rotations. And
no,
it,
I haven't seen a roller one for ever.
Mine's rolling right now, Dave.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. They do have an external thumb roller on them, but that's not what does the counting. That is not what does the counting. That is just a convenient thumb roller on it. It's got like, I'm going to have to get mine out now.
Was it in the channel?
Sorry.
I don't actually know how this works, I guess.
Mine's actually got a thumb roller on it, but.
Yeah, mine is a thumb roller as well.
Yeah, but yeah. No, but that is only for your convenience of, you know, because with that, you can do
like
sort of
micro adjustments.
Fine adjustments. Yeah, how it works. In fact, mine doesn't even make contact. My roller wheel actually pivots off it. So it's only when I push on it does it actually make contact. No, these are actually capacitively sensed.
I feel like there's a video in here, Dave. This is good. You should make a video. Yeah.
I was going to, but then other people have already done it.
Oh, okay. So I should look it up.
Quite a few videos out there. If you search for how digital calipers work, there's tons of videos out there.
Caliper videos.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I should maybe, you know.
Why not?
Anyway, so I have a decent,
I didn't know that works.
Brand one here. I actually paid for a good quality brand. Mine's a iGaming. Mine's an iGaging brand, which is apparently like a more upmarket. Mine's the Easy Cow iGager, so it's premium quality.
Anyways, I would use that over. Although I don't know how they work, apparently I would use a caliper over a ruler most days.
It depends on what you're doing, you know. If you just want to,
I don't know.
If I was ever to get a tattoo, I would go the Adam Savage route and get a ruler tattooed on my forearm.
Oh yeah, what about saggy skin though?
But it's just, you know, it's good enough for Australia, right?
Okay.
It's like, you know. Just...
Jimmy Rogers, who's in the maker scene, actually got resistor color codes, like a rainbow of resistor color codes. It was great.
Actual colored tattoo with the color code.
Yeah, like
really?
All of the different colors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, I'll see if I can find a photo. It's great. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, please. We can include that as the thumbnail if we can find the photo.
Hey, we don't know that image. We don't own it. Remember?
Oh, you come on. But it's easy
how about
to
this?
See.
Did you see the thing about the lawsuit up against Midjourney's and Midjourney and all the others?
I heard like something about it. I haven't looked into details about,
I don't know what it's going to be interesting what happens, comes out of it. I don't know.
But then if their defense can be, well, you allow Google to index your images. So, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how the legal stuff's going to work out. It's a copyright claim thing, so it's the US. Yeah.
If you're suing us and not suing them, you know, it might be like, I don't know, right? I'm not a legal expert, but I my spidey sense tells me that it could be something along the lines of patent law. Like, if you don't defend your patent, like legally, then you kind of lose the right to do it. That is ingrained in somehow in patent law, in some aspect. Some
not
aspect
quite correct. Yeah, I know what you mean. But
I know it's not 100%
trademark
correct.
Law for sure. That's a trademark.
Sorry, trademark. Trademark. If you don't defend your trademark, if you let people, you know, if you let people actually abuse your trademark and you don't defend it, you can't. That actually makes it harder for you to defend against someone else later. So I think a similar sort of thing might be at play here. Don't quote me on that, but
I don't know if I agree with that. But
yeah, but I think a lawyer could.
One thing that did happen in the U.S. though is that generated images. Then, so like if you generate images from Midjourney, whatever, those cannot be copyrighted in the U.S. right now.
Yes, so yes, that's right.
If people want to steal our blog art and spread Ampower blog images around, actually we would appreciate it.
Which I think is fine, because that's not really the issue. The issue is the artist who owns the original
sourced.
Work it's based on. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't think anyone who generates anything using Midjourney is concerned about copyrighting it. Like, I think that very few.
Well, people are like making books out of it. So I've actually talked to my wife about this. Like doing a children's book would be pretty easy. Right?
Yeah. But what? People are going to steal your cover? Well, you know, so be it. But.
Well, no. So if you can't enforce copyright, you don't own the characters then, right? So then nobody's going to publish you. So like, say I went and made a children's book.
Oh, okay, right.
I talked about with my wife, actually. It was like, oh, it'd be fun to like use Midjourney, make a, you know, we've had some ideas for children's
books. You can make a kid's book or something. Right?
Read enough of them. Everybody thinks they can do one.
Right.
And I was like, oh, yeah, we could do that. But then we could find a publisher. But if you can't publish, if you can't copyright generated images, they're not going to invest in the IP.
Basically. Right, right.
It's not defensible.
Yeah, so. But is that their problem? Because they're just the publisher of the book. They just sell books. They don't.
Well, what recourses do they have then, right? I mean, they're basically, you know, most publishers are just IP houses, right? They're
Yeah, then somebody else could come along and sue you to take down the book.
It's not hard to print a book. It's not hard to download it to a Kindle, right? I mean, like, you can download the EPUB, right? And if it was broadly put on the internet and you didn't have any recourse against it, you couldn't sue the person that had put it on the on a website and everybody downloaded it. So I don't think publishers would go for it.
Right. I think you might be right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's too bad.
Yeah, well. Wow, self-published. Who needs a publisher these days?
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Speaking of IP, former guest of the show and Silicon Wunderkind will be generating some IP in the near first future because Sam Zaloof has started a chip company with someone, Jim Keller? I don't know who Jim Keller was. Should I know who Jim Keller was?
Well, you should. He designed like some AMD chips and the Apple A4 processor and all sorts of things, I think. So he's a huge, like he's probably one of the big names in the chip industry if you're into the chip industry. Yeah, Jim Keller is like, you know.
I mean, he was smart to get into business with that legend.
Yeah,
you know.
I would love to know how that connection came about, actually.
You know, I had breakfast with Sam right before I moved out of Chicago. So that's about a year and a half ago now.
Yeah.
And he was talking about I saw him at a conference, I think, too. But I think he was trying to build a fab for fabs he talked about. Maybe that's what they're doing here.
Okay.
I don't remember, but... Anyways, we knew. I mean, we knew this kid was going to do something crazy, right?
No, totally. I did listen to that episode just the other day. So it's great. Yeah.
We should see if maybe both of those two would like to come back on. We'll give them a shout. But yeah, so they raised a bunch of money.
They raised $15 million from, and this is the interesting thing: who the money's from.
This is interesting.
It's from OpenAI.
I know, right?
Right. So is there going to be, like, why would OpenAI invest? They're not, like, you know, invest in something that's not really related to their industry. Right. So it's not like they're an investment company, right? So why would they do that?
They're not making any money yet, so.
No, but unless some OpenAI tech is going to be used in the design of the chips, perhaps.
Maybe it'll generate memes and then they'll put that into silicon.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good to me.
Yeah. I'm all for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway. Go Sam. Yep. Go Jim.
Yep. So, there's a $15 million investment for a $100 million valuation for this startup. And they're hiring people. So, that's the only thing on their website at the moment is some jobs going. So, they're hiring people. So, if you're a hardware, I think they've got a process engineer, a hardware engineer, or I don't know, software or something. So they're and they're going to be building their own fab equipment where it's not already available.
I've done all those things. I could go work there.
Good.
I've been a process engineer. I've been a hardware engineer.
There
I've
wrote,
written some software.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
I'm the perfect. They can't afford me. They can't afford
$100,000 to $150,000 for the process engineer, which doesn't sound like much for Silicon Valley. Someone just mentioned this on Twitter.
Oh,
it's like you couldn't even get lunch for $100,000 in San Fran, can you?
I don't know about in the Bay Area, but I do know that, you know, process engineers, so like, don't get paid a ton because usually they're not, you know, you think about like versus like a, I don't know, like a DevOps engineer, right? Like someone who's doing like deploying large servers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like there's just not as much demand, it feels like.
It's a pretty unglamorous industry, right? It's not a high profile, high competition.
I work in it.
honestly,
I think the other thing too is that the most process engineers come from chemical engineering, right? And so.
Right. Okay.
The best ones I knew were chemical engineers, at least.
Right, makes sense, yeah.
And I think there's just a lot more of them. They don't get paid. You know, like if you're working in petroleum in the U.S., you get paid really well as a process engineer.
Yep.
But like...
Oh, you would get more in the chemical industry for driving the truck at the mine that mines the chemicals than you would for actually, you know... See, I'm completely serious. You would get paid more for driving the truck at the mine that mines the chemicals.
I mean, it's hazard pay, so...
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a weird world. It's not a equitable world. Let's put it that way.
I think it is detached. You know, like value is detached from pay in a lot of industries.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way the world works. That's just how the cookie crumbles, man.
Yep.
And sucks, but
anyway, they are after, I think you only need like a year or two experience or something like that. So it's not like they're after like some, you know, industry veteran process engineer or something. So but the interesting thing is that they're supposedly talking about, well, if we can't buy the stuff we need, we're going to make it, you know, and they want to own the entire process from start from raw silicon, you know, right up. So,
You know, Dave, it says Atomic Semi on their job listing. It says Atomic Semi is building a small, fast semiconductor fab. You know, it doesn't get much smaller than on the desktop.
It's not going to happen, dude. Still clinging onto that hype, dude.
If it was going to happen, I think it's Sam's aloof. I think Sam is, I've told Sam, he's my only shot. So if anyone's going to do it, it's him.
Yep, but sorry, dude.
Probably not.
Still stands. I'm happy to give you another 10-year bet. You lost the last one.
Yeah, okay.
You know, happy to give it to you.
Yeah. That's very, very generous of you. Very generous.
I'm happy to keep extending it every 10 years. It's like it's like fusion, you know. Yeah. It's just not going to happen, dude.
Dream on. Other things that are dreams and other people who have been on the show in the recent past. So Matt Venn was on the show talking about SillyWiz, and that is something he worked on with another guest of the show, Uri Shaked, out of Israel, and it is now generally available. So app.sillywiz.com, we will link that in here. You can go and try it out.
And just bam, I'm straight in. Don't have to sign up. It just, there
nope,
it is.
No,
I've got my I've got my silicon designer, and I've got like a DRC cross section, which shows the vertical, you know, you can see if you've got any DRC errors on your silicon, and it's just there. Yeah. Bam, straight in.
Yeah, you start with presets here. So like if you're following along at home, if you click
inverter
on the preset, you click inverter. That's right. So you see
what
the
is
different
a skull
gates
here. FET? What is a skull FET? Oh, it's actually got a skull and crossbones. It's actually a FET made with skull and crossbones.
Uri makes a puzzle with skulls in it, so I think it's got to be something like that.
All right.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like the inverter is like a classic thing. You, like Dave said, you can have cross sections here. One thing I didn't mention to Dave before the show as well, in the upper right corner, there's a link to the lessons, and that goes to basically kind of a walkthrough. Like, so like how do you think about parasitics? How do you think about how to actually draw capacitors, draw FETs, draw a logic inverter? So like, so building up from scratch as well, because this is even something that I think, you know, this is a level below, when Matt was on the show, he was talking about this. This is a level below how most of the time you're doing this kind of stuff. Usually you're not individually tweaking like an inverter. It's going to generate that for you from Verilog, right? It's going to actually do that for you.
That would just be a standard drop-in thing you would get from the silicon vendor, right?
Yeah, you get cells and it uses the cells there. But then if you wanted to then go and do an analog design,
that's totally different. You got to tweak it manually. Yep.
Right, and that's basically what's going on here. So then now you can click on something like the input gate. You could modify the width of like the gate. You can change the thickness of the gate as well, and then you can actually see how the curves change and how you know, if you have different pulses coming in or what does it look like. And it's, I don't know, it's just like, it's amazing. I mean, really, it's just amazing. Yeah,
this is begging for AI. This is begging for ChatGPT support. Like, please make my MOSFET a bit faster. And then it just redraws the geometry to make it faster. Trade off power consumption for speed. You know, and it just knows how to do that.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting too. So we were just talking about like, you know, what is process engineering? And like one thing that you would do as a process engineer there is basically you would say like, you know, you'd design an experiment. You'd say like, okay, I have a theory that if I change the width of the input gate, right?
Yeah.
Then I think I'm going to like map it from width A to width B. And then, you know, you do that. And then you also then you do a cross with maybe another theory like, oh, I'm going to change the P diffusion depth. And I think that's going to have this other effect. And then what you do is you kind of run these different things in parallel and you see like what has the most impact from that sort of thing. And like, that's also what an AI would do if it was doing that sort of thing, but you can do this.
Well, they do have simulators for this sort of thing, right? You can simulate, like you don't have to do the physical experiment like each time you want to
do that. This is a simulator.
Yes,
but yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah. That would be like, I forget what that command is. Man, it's been a while since I did Spice. Oh, and I told you about it. Remember I told you I downloaded Spice? I know, LT Spice on my computer.
Right, yeah. And it had,
It had like notes from 1999 in there. 1999. That like, yeah,
that's great.
That Mike must have put in there.
Yeah, that is great.
Apparently, Mike Englehart, who was on the show way back when, he was at LT Spice. He left ADI when, so like LT Spice is now part of Analog Devices. Mm-hmm. Mike's no longer there. He is now releasing some new simulator soon that's independent.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, there you go. Wow.
I got another one.
He actually branched his own code, did he? Is it because LT Spice isn't open source, right?
It is not open source, but he was the big maintainer of it. And we'll link in that episode as well. That was...
So did he write it again from scratch?
I think he did.
Holy crap.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I remember that episode. I think it was just me. Do you remember if you were on
that one? Yeah, I think it was just you. Yeah. I remember.
He said so many software terms. Like, I remember, like, literally, like, having to catch my breath that confused about, about, like, what was going on and what he was saying. Like, I really.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was tough. My brain hurt afterwards. So. But I will link in the name. It had, like, a weird name. It was, like, some, like, Roman, like, Latin. It was in Latin or something. But there's a new simulator coming, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool bananas. Yeah.
You download LT Spice.
I was just asking. I can't remember who or where I was asking it, but like, what is the latest? Maybe it was you. We're casually talking about it. What is the latest go-to simulator these days? I think before a show the other week, I think we were.
Yeah, I think we were talking about
about it.
And and I said I don't know.
Same here.
KiCad has it built in now. It's just okay though. Like that's P Spice. LT Spice is still good. Honestly, like if I'm doing something fast, I'm probably going to Falstad just because I love how it animates and stuff. I think that's like.
Oh yeah, if I'm doing a simulator, I'm just going to one of those web things. And usually, I don't want to simulate my whole design. I just want to simulate like a couple of transistors or something. You know, I just want to like a little building block.
That's right.
So yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
There you go.
To Matt and Uri, though, this is I'm very excited about this Silly Whiz thing. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really looks cool. Agreed.
Speaking of, we might as well hop back on that AI train. I heard rumor that you tried to get someone to do your homework for you.
Somebody did do my homework. The bot did my homework.
Yeah.
You know how I've been working on this MacGyver project, I call it, which is a BOM, which looks like a BOME, so we don't get demonetized. Well, this isn't monetized anyway. So a bomb. It looks like a bomb.
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 Yeah, right.
It looks like a bomb. It's a bomb countdown timer, right? Hello, NSA, if you're listening.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we just triggered, all we have to do is mention the president in the same sentence and we're going to get flagged at the NSA. Yep. Anyway. All right.
Dave said it.
So I was originally going to do like a how to design part three was going to be how to design it using discrete TTL logic. And then I was going to show how, you need like 30 chips or something. And then I was going to show how you convert that into a single 8-pin micro. Right. But then I thought, no, why can't I just get AI? It'd be more interesting to get AI to actually see if it can drive this display. Because it's an interesting thing. What I'm trying to do is drive 5 7-segment displays connected to 5 shift registers, right? 7400 series shift registers, 74164s, right? And so it's got a serial clock in, it's got a serial data in. And, so I thought this is like an interesting experiment for ChatGPT AI to see if it can, like, I know that ChatGPT can write code, right? It can write code for almost anything.
Arduino code.
Somebody said it can even write code for that Padook.
Oh, really? Oh,
3-cent microcontroller. Yeah. Somebody said it even does that. So it just, it just trawls GitHub and finds all this code and just magically, learns it, right? So it can do practically any language. It can generate assembler for PIC, I think. It can do like.
So like, I do wonder about the depth of that too. Like, as a prompt engineer.
Yes.
One thing that's tough is like, how many like nested statements could you get? Like, I want it to run a timer, but I also want it to do this. And I also want it to do that. And I also want it to do that. Like that feels like that's where it's going to get gummed up as well, because it's just describing all the things you want it to do.
Right. If it's trying to do like a real time interrupt driven thing, can it?
Yeah, exactly.
Can it handle that? Right. I don't know, but. Anyway, so I thought this was an interesting, so I know I can write code. I know I can write Arduino code, no problem. But can I describe a hardware circuit with 7-segment displays and shift registers? Can I understand that and then how to drive that and translate that in, and how to, and can I translate that into an English, because it's a language-based processor, right? It only understands language, right?
Right, because you wouldn't be, if you were explaining this to me too, you wouldn't want to like, you wouldn't want to send me a schematic, right? You wouldn't want to say, oh, well, actually pin 5 of chip 1 is tied to pin 7 of chip 2.
So so what I did is I thought about it for like 2 seconds. I didn't even put any effort into it, right? I thought about how can I explain the function of this circuit in a few sentences, right? So you can see it in the video. There's a few sentences I type in, and bam, it got it practically first go. There are two bugs in the code that it got. It got a complete newbie mistake where it was decrementing a variable in a loop that it should have made a temporary copy of first and then operated on the temporary variable, right? So it was decrementing the loop value, right? Which was dumb, right? It's just a complete newbie mistake, right? So it made that mistake.
If people are trusting this thing and like trusting it for increasingly interesting and dangerous things, it really scares me.
Yep.
That it might be basing anything off of my old code.
Right.
Some of which is,
same here.
It's available on the internet, so it has consumed my code.
It has. It
has taken my knowledge and added it to the repository, right?
Gamma logic trademark, yeah.
Yeah. Oh boy.
So anyway, and the other bug was that it didn't realize that the Arduino had a 16-bit integer and not a 32-bit integer. So I was playing with a 5-digit number that exceeded the integer value of 32,768, right? So it exceeded that. So that's why it actually failed. It actually compiled fine, but there were two bugs that made it didn't work. And it did ultimately require a human, i.e. me, to fix those bugs. But geez, it was... I couldn't believe that it actually understood the function of shift registers. It understood the mapping of 7-segment displays. It got the mapping all correct. I would like to think that's because of my prompt engineering skills.
I described it
in inadequate detail. I'm sure that played a role. But it understood that a 7-segment display, and it understood that it had a decimal point, and it understood that it had to generate a routine to map all of these segments to the digits, and then it needed to shift them out in the correct order, in the correct thing, and it was just, bam, it nailed all that. So it actually understood hardware and then translated it into software to drive the hardware. It's really quite something. This is different to just writing code.
Here's an interesting question. I mean, that is impressive. Both on the prompt side, like that's non-trivial. And so I'm excited to watch this, actually. Here's a question for you. If you hired another helper like David too, and he came up and he said, I wrote this code and it works.
Yep.
And then a week later, he's like, you find a bug. And then he blamed it on, I'm not saying David too, I'm going to say Bobby McGee here is the new person. And then later he said, actually, it was ChatGPT, it wasn't me. How would you feel about that?
Oh, to find out my employee used ChatGPT?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, right?
I wouldn't care. I'm paying them to do a job. Can you get the job done? I don't care which tools you... Well, I kind of do care which tools you use.
Right.
Yeah, there is some care there, but ultimately, bottom line is, can you get the job done? Whether or not you're a genius who codes it in assembler, or whether or not you're somebody who is really great skilled at using ChatGPT. Ultimately, engineering is about getting a task done.
Is the solving the problem. I totally agree. Yeah. I think the real thing is I'm not sure I trust the thing enough. And now you're basically putting ghosts into a machine as well, right? What if they're not good enough to find a bug, right? You know what I mean?
That is the thing. ChatGPT did find the bug with the integer, but only because I prompted it. Like, I knew it was a bug and I prompted it that, hey, do you think something's wrong here? And then it rechecked it. So it was like, so it required, without that human knowing that the bug was there, it would not have solved that, right? Yeah. Hmm. And the interesting part about this, right, it really tries to help you, right? So even if somebody, I asked this on Twitter, is there a word for this? And somebody said bot-splaining, right? Which I think is a pretty good term, right? So I think I'm going to use that from now on, bot-splaining. Yeah, what funny. It does is title. The ChatGPT will bend over backwards, like if you tell it, it's, oh, you're wrong here, can you fix it? It'll bend over backwards to try and fix it. Yeah, it'll actually modify stuff that is correct and then get more and more confused. It starts hallucinating issues, right? Seriously, the chat, it starts, that's the best description. It starts hallucinating these issues and solving problems. And you can see it in my video. It gets so completely muddled, it thought the fault. You know, I kept badgering it, saying, you know, like, there's a problem here, can you fix it? And then it starts going, imagining that there's, hallucinating that there's a fault in the routine, that there's nothing wrong with that routine, right? And so it starts making changes to that routine, and it goes down that rabbit hole of it start, it really, rather than actually defend itself and go, no, I am right.
I'm a computer,
be,
you're an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. No, it doesn't do that. Yeah. It does not do that. It just, it bends over backwards, and it'll get completely muddled up its own clacker trying to find, you know, trying to solve your issue for you. It's too helpful, right?
Yeah.
In the, to its own detriment, and to your detriment too, because you're trying to think. But yeah, ultimately, like, I'm amazed at what it did, but ultimately it did require my human skill and knowledge of the code to actually fix it.
So we get another week or two before.
Oh yeah, it's jobs are gone. Before it learns that, you know, I should have given it like a tick to say, solved
it. I do think, you know, I think about like this kind of stuff, and people always are like, oh, but what about the jobs that are like, oh man, bring it on. Like, I just need so much help, you know. You know.
Yeah. It's not going to take away jobs. I see it as another valuable tool. You know, and it's incredible, especially for generating tedious stuff. Like my example of mapping the 7 segments to the displays, it got all that right, right? That's a tedious part of programming that I hate, is like mapping stuff. If you've got a huge, bitmap display, you need to map things into and stuff like that. That's kind of like the tedious work that, is boring. If you can get the AI to just generate and do the monotonous stuff, then, it's great. But I'll tell you something more interesting, and after this, I'll probably shoot a video on it. I didn't shoot my reaction last night, but because I did it late last night. I got in there, and because it keeps the chat that you've previously got, right? Because you can build on your existing chat with it. So it keeps that. Mm-hmm. Even when you log out, you log back in, it's all got my existing chat there, so I can pick up where I left off. So I asked it. I said something along the lines of, imagine that you're a digital electronics designer. Right. So I told it, imagine you're a digital electronics designer. Can you explain how I can make this same code with 7400 series logic? Right. Because that was going to be my next video, is how to do the same function using 7400 series logic.
Like how to spit out so not running Arduino now. And you really are having to do your homework here, huh?
Not running on Arduino, but use the existing stuff I've told it to. And it started like it thought it was the longest pause I've ever had on ChatGPT, right? It sat there for like a good 20 seconds before it, started to spit it out. But then it said, certainly, let me explain how to do this. I will have to. Oh, no, I can't. I can't give you the thing right now. But
I'll watch the video when it comes out.
It basically went through step by step. You need, and then it gave me a bomb. It gave me a bill of materials. You need 5 74HC595s. You need X number of 10K resistors. You need these. You need 220 ohm resistors for the dropper. It knew and figured out that the 7 segment displays were common cathode.
Based on part number? Or no?
I don't know if it figured that out or whether or not it assumed that, because I never used the term common cathode in my previous descriptions of it. So I don't know if it assumed it or it figured that out, that it needed common cathode displays. And then, so it gave me a bill of materials. Then it explained that I needed a 555 timer to generate the clock. Then it gave me the formula for the 555 timer to generate the 1 hertz period signal. Then it told me I needed an inverted clock using NAND gates, for one for latching the data and one for shifting the data, right? And I haven't drawn it up yet, but I think it's kind of wrong. Like I guarantee it's wrong, right? But the fact that it did this is just stunning.
Like it's indexed just, the Hackaday comments, and it's like, well, you could have done this with the 555.
Yeah, and it gave me a bill of materials and then explained in monotonous detail, and then it ran out of puff, right? And then I said, please continue. And then it continued, it needed like a part two to explain all this stuff. And I was just, even though it's not correct, like, there's lots of gobbledygook in there, right? That is not technically correct, right? That would not solve the actual problem.
If there's one thing Dave can really appreciate, it's things that ramble on.
Yes, exactly. But I was so impressed that it rambled on. And again, it is the pleasing nature. Like the AI tries to please you. And even though it's wrong, it's the fact that I don't know what percentage of it is actually right. Like, but there's a lot of stuff that helps you, you know. Yes, you need these registers and you need, and then it said, oh, well, the how you do the counter is based on how you want to implement, and you can use several 7400 series logic chips to actually do this. That's up to you to decide. And I can probably continue the chat and say, well, can you recommend a counter chip to do this, you know? And like, so I'm probably going to do that after this.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about it too, where it's like if it's gonna put in opinion and tell you like, oh, I don't want to operate like that too. Yeah. It would be like, you know, you really want to be doing this with 74 series logic.
Right, right. Yeah. If it's real,
kind of old.
Are you sure you want to do it?
Yeah.
This is very 1980s, you know? Like,
yeah, kinda, right. I have a lot of data about this, but...
But are you sure you want to do it, you know? Yeah, right, it'd be much easier to use an 8-pin micro to do this.
Yeah, right.
Actually, I could ask it that. Which is the most efficient way to do this, using a microcontroller or using 7400 series logic, you know, to see what it says? But I'm just stunned that it went into so much detail, even if the detail is not, you know, only 50% correct. The fact that it could do it, you'll be amazed when I show you the printout that it gave me. It's just, you know, yeah. Even though it's wrong, I don't care. I'm just like stunned at the technology. Wow, just wow. Yep, blown away.
We are already past an hour, so I feel like we should go into link mode here.
Let's go.
Here we go. Link mode. So Andreas Spies, past guest of the show as well. Really cool video, actually, about, you know, we're talking at the top about connecting your stuff over IoT. This is a thing called OpenMQTT Gateway, where basically, you know, those like weather stations are like 433 megahertz.
Yep.
This is basically like it's a converter that you can program directly on an ESP32 that actually kind of like snips for packets from, you know, sensors you and your neighbors might have. And then it can just push them up to the network. Like super cool. Like,
nice.
Yeah. So going, and then, you know, like there's all this stuff about like home assistant. Have you ever done home assistant stuff?
I do have a system.
Oh, you do?
Okay. But it's not very good. Yeah. It's the Z-Wave system. It's a Z-Wave.
No. Home assistant is the software package.
Oh, right. No. No. I don't.
Yeah. So there's like this open source. I think I'm saying it right. There's like an Apple one, and then there's the open source one, and I always get those confused. I think it's right, though. I think Home Assistant is. And basically, it's like, you should check it out. It's actually pretty cool, because like, you just kind of generate these things called YAML files, and basically you say like, oh, actually, this thing is going to be hooked up to a sensor. Again, another thing that AI might be interested in.
I don't want to automate my home with YAML files, no.
No. It's not that. It generates code for the ESP32. So you say like, oh, I have a, you know, this type of sensor, and it's going to be hooked up to these pins of the ESP32. Yep. And then it just writes the code for you, basically. That's all you have to do.
Right.
Is just
okay.
Like basically hook those things together and you're done.
Cool.
And then Home Assistant like helps you to kind of create sensor networks in your home that if you wanted to do that sort of thing.
Got it. All right.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. What else is on the list? Lots of great links again, thanks to Unmanaged 615.
Yes, there is. Yeah, like he just puts everything on there. Crazy.
Just champ.
Which gets mirrored to our Amp Hour Twitter account, by the way. So if it's handy to follow the Amp Hour Twitter account, because we don't tweet anything apart from the show episodes, and there's an automated thingo that if you post something on the Reddit, then that link automatically goes over to the Twitter account, so you don't even have to use Reddit to follow the links. So it's just handy. These links just pop up. It's really good.
KiCad 7 is released. That's a big one. So new year, I'm trying to say KiCad more instead of KiCad. I'm trying to do it, Dave. And it's great. I mean, I did a video at the end of last year with the team where we kind of going over stuff that's available. The big one that I think is actually really important for companies adopting it is there's actually that database. You can actually build a part database for yourself now instead of like doing it through individual files. And so you think about like revision controlling it, but then also like having multiple inputs into that database and being able to have a librarian that that works. You know, you could really start to build out some serious infrastructure. And another one that a lot of people like, but I don't personally, you might like this sort of thing. There's like scalable bitmaps that you can pull into the layout now. So say you wanted to go and recreate an old PCB and without any of the schematic symbols, you basically just pull it into the bitmap layout and then you connect it all up basically with tracing over top of what the board looks like.
Oh, nice. Okay. Oh, so you can use it as a template, a tracing template.
That's right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Nice. Yep. Yeah.
That's like, and again, that's like some people, like depending on what kind of work you're doing, like some people are doing like vintage electronics and that is critical.
Yeah.
But I don't use that sort of thing.
You could also take a photo of a board and then a photo of the traces on the board, and then you could reverse and then you could convert that into a new file. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So lots of great, I mean, really, really great stuff in the new version. They delivered on the promise and they actually released a version on time. And I think by next January, there'll be an 8.0, which is pretty crazy.
Awesome.
What else? Anything else you see on the list? I mean, there's other, like I said, a lot of stuff
there's
here.
Tons of stuff, but no, we'd have to talk
there's
about
a remastered
it.
Version of the mother of all demos. I think we've talked about that on the show.
Oh, really? Okay. Yes, we have talked about the mother of all demos, Douglas Engelhardt.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Legend.
Absolute legend. That was, when I was talking about the Xerox PARC book that I loved, that was in there. I think we probably talked about it then at least.
Yep, fantastic.
Among other times. Yeah, so cool. Unbelievable. Yeah, I think that's it. People can go check out the subreddit.
Or follow it on Twitter.
That's right. All right.
We're done.
That's all for me. Yeah. Have a good week, man.
Maybe, you know, will AI take our jobs by next week?
Yeah. We can only hope.
No. Right. Well, the voice, the AI voice thing's getting really good. It's got so much material it can learn from. It's all public. It can learn our voices. Yeah. It can simulate voices.
Yeah, but can it bring the witty repartee that we bring to the show every single week, Dave? I don't think a computer can do that yet.
Maybe I can try it. Yeah. Because Machiavelli's Underbelly, who's a Twitter user, that's his Twitter name.
Sure.
He's like an AI expert and he generates all these AI videos of well-known people like saying things, you know, like, and it's absolutely amazing. Maybe we can get him to sort of simulate our voice and make us say something.
I would love it.
Yeah. Maybe I
want to think so I don't have to record the intro each week. I can just type it in.
You can just type it in.
That'd be great.
That,
especially
like
when I travel.
The intro. Yeah, of course.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'll contact him on Twitter and see if he wants to see if he can generate our voices
Bring
to make
it
us say
on.
Anything. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because all our stuff's out there. We can't stop it. Like it's going to troll our previous episodes and it's going to learn and
only 621 of them plus
all right, catch you next time.
See ya.